Thanks so much for joining us here on the show. It's brought to you in part by Gulf Shore Playhouse, changing lives through exceptional theater experiences. And I hope you'll visit the website, gulfshoreplayhouse.org. Coming up, we're going to visit with Larry Reed. He is the Chairman Emeritus of the Foundation for Economic Education. Right now, we have with us Mark Schulman. Mark is the founder and publisher of a terrific multimedia website. It's called HistoryCentral.com. I hope you check it out, HistoryCentral.com. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Bob.
Thank you, Mark. I understand you're at a special location today.
Yes, I am. I'm in the port of Joppa, which is part of Tel Aviv, but it's the old city of which Tel Aviv originated from. It's called Joppa. It was the port for which pilgrims used to come to Jerusalem. They would come by boat to Joppa for many, many years, and then they would go from Joppa up to Jerusalem. There was actually a train built in the end. End of the Ottoman rule, they built a train that went from Jaffa to Jerusalem.
Huh.
So this is the port of Jaffa. And today it's really it's not a port for a commercial port, but there are, you know, excursions take place and a few fishing boats and other things like that from this old port.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for that. Now, Jerusalem and Israel has been in the news lately. Any update on terms of the protests and so forth?
Well, the protests continue. I mean, this Saturday night, there were probably about 130,000 people in the streets of Tel Aviv. Keep in mind, this was the 33rd week in a row.
Yeah.
I mean, just think about that, that every single week, these huge numbers of people come out. They're not going to allow the government to do what it wants to do without a fight. It's not at all clear where that's going at this point. Part of the problem that the government is now running into is because so many reserve pilots and others have said they would not continue to volunteer to serve. There is a sense that the Israel Defense Forces may not be ready for war if this continues much longer. And so Netanyahu is trying to ignore it, but he can't really ignore it at this point. So it's not at all clear where this is going. Really isn't.
Yeah.
And your guess is as good as mine. And part of it will be tied to when we talk about Saudi Arabia in a minute.
Yeah, so it's just so typical what's happening around the world and around the globe today. So let's move to Ukraine and an update on what's happening there.
Okay, so there are a couple of parts to the Ukraine story as of right now. There seems to have been, and again, it's the fog of war, so we really don't know, some significant breakthrough yesterday by the Ukrainians in Russian lines. How significant it is, it's still not at all clear. Both sides are going to try to keep it quiet as long as possible. The Russians don't want to be embarrassed, and the Ukrainians want to advance as far as they can without the Russians realizing where they are. So it's not clear. I've been disappointed in the sense that I thought the Ukrainians would do better by this point. On the other hand, I look at history and I look at World War I, which is most similar to, and what happened to the Russian army. They fought, and then they fell apart and folded away. And soldiers ran back to Russia. I still believe that's most likely what's going to happen in this case.
Yeah.
That at some point the Russian army is going to collapse. But we'll see. You just don't know.
Well, the report is that the Russian army is being decimated slowly but surely. I mean, this whole process is taking a long, long time. But they are making inroads into taking back some of the territory that Russia claimed.
No, absolutely. And the Russian army is being totally decimated over a period of time. I mean, it's the best investment we've ever made. It's too bad for the Ukrainians that are dying doing it. But as opposed to other interventions in the world where we question whether it was Vietnam, the lesser extent Korea, but other places in the Gulf War, you know, we always said, you know, why are we fighting and where aren't the people who really matter fighting? Well, in this case, the people who really matter are doing fighting. We're just providing them with money and arms. So it's a pretty good deal from our standpoint, to say the least.
Yeah, I wish we had the money to do it.
So. Well, that's another story. You know, the money to do it is all a relative thing, so to speak. We could just raise taxes; that would solve the problem. But no one wants to raise taxes. So, money doesn't come from nowhere. And I just remind your listeners that when John F. Kennedy became president, the highest tax rate in the United States was 90%.
Right, and he lowered the taxes, and I mean, the Laffer curve still reigns. We've seen a decrease in the tax rates in the United States under Trump, and we've actually seen a substantial increase in revenue.
I'm not sure about that, but we'll leave that part aside. The fact of the matter is, We have a low tax rate, which is fine, but we can't complain about the fact there isn't money if we don't tax more. So, you know, sometimes you have a one-time tax, a war tax. Don't forget what happened in World War II.
Yeah.
It wasn't a tax forever. There was a war tax. That could also be done if we think it's important enough.
The problem is those taxes just...
It's all a question of priorities.
Yeah, taxes just never go away, though. They be implemented, but for some reason they just stick around. Let's move to Saudi Arabia. You brought up Saudi Arabia with regard to Israel.
I brought up Saudi Arabia because there's a lot of talk of a three-way deal at the moment between the United States and Saudi Arabia, but also involving Israel. So the Saudis want a couple of things from the United States. They want advanced weaponry. They want access to civilian nuclear power, and they want some sort of a defense agreement with the United States. In return, the Saudis, of course, will increase the oil production, become closer to the United States, be in the American orbit, and in terms of Israel, if Israel does certain things in terms of the Palestinians, in terms of making their lives a little bit easier, Saudi Arabia will recognize Israel and end the state of war that exists between Israel and the Saudi Arabian. I mean, there is a lot of commercial action that takes place between the two countries right now, but it's under the table, so to speak. So that's the deal. There are a couple of real big sticking points. The biggest one of them is the fact that the Saudis don't only want nuclear power; they want the ability to enrich their own uranium.
Uh-huh.
And that's where it gets a little bit dicey. Because the minute you can enrich your own uranium for the purposes of a power plant, you can also enrich your own uranium for the purposes of a bomb.
Right.
And so therein it gets kind of dicey, and it's not at all clear what makes sense at this moment. I know the Israeli defense establishment is against the deal. A lot of people in the United States Congress, of course, considering Khashoggi and some of the other things in Saudi Arabia, don't really support this deal either. So it's not clear where it's going. But it is being negotiated, and being negotiated in good faith, it would seem. And we'll see where it takes us at this point.
So, just the parties in negotiation are the United States and Saudi Arabia?
The United States and Saudi Arabia are the main parties in negotiations. Israel is sort of on the side in the negotiations because part of the incentive is ending the state of war with Saudi Arabia. But part of the requirements is for Israel to do certain things vis-a-vis the Palestinians. So Israel is a player in the negotiations, but they're not involved directly in the negotiations.
Got it. So, and speaking of which, we're in that part of the world. How about in Iran and the deal that apparently the Biden administration is trying to work out with Iran with regard to the exchange of $6 billion in...
So that deal comes down to the following. The Iranians have been holding a bunch of American dual citizens, let's put it that way, in captivity for the last, some of them as many as 6 or 7 years. The United States always makes attempts to get their prisoners home. In this case, the deal is not to give, it's not giving the Iranians any direct money, but it's releasing Iranian money that was held in escrow in South Korea. And so this was something that the South Koreans wanted. The United States wanted to get its citizens home. There's clearly a larger part of this deal is taking place very quietly. Is it good or bad? That's a hard question to answer without knowing the full extent of the deal and whether the Iranians are going to keep their part of the bargain. Again, listen, if you're one of the family members of these people, obviously you think this is good.
Yeah.
And this is always the problem, right? The problem with American hostages held, whether it's in Russia or anywhere else, what do? Do not negotiate and let them rot in prison forever? Or do you find ways to getting them home? And that's always a very, very difficult trade-off, let's put it that way.
Doesn't that kind of lead to the whole opportunity to let's kidnap some American and perhaps we can get a deal to get lots of money?
At some levels that's true. But, you're talking about things that take many, these people have been held in captivity for many years. It's not like they capture them today and now they want, now they want money. I mean, my view is if rogue actors try to capture Americans, that's time for the SEALs to come in and take care of the problem.
Yeah.
It's a much bigger problem when big state actors do it and they don't want to go to war over it. So what do you do? And again, it's a difficult moral choice, right? You let these people rot in jail forever, or do you make concessions that you might not necessarily want to make, but, you know, there's a price to everything. So, again, I'm glad I'm not the person who has to make that decision.
Good point. So, Mark, let's move to China. We're beginning to see some cracks in the armor here a little bit because of the reports.
Very big cracks in the armor, actually. You had a situation where exports and imports were down in this past quarter, which shows a complete slowing of the economy. The unemployment rate has grown. The unemployment rate amongst college-educated young people is now 20%.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a serious problem. Now, it's a serious problem on multiple levels. One level, of course, you know, the regime made a deal, basically, with its people. You stay out of politics, and we'll make sure you're rich. Well, some version of it. I was not always rich, but, you know, you do well. You reach the middle class, the upper middle class, and all is well.
Right.
But if suddenly you can't give jobs when you finish college, that starts becoming a bigger problem, let's put it that way. Second of all, you know, we've had this discussion before, but I go back once again to the fact that, you know, we thought Japan was going to take over the world, right?
Right.
In the 80s, beginning of the 90s. They would take over the world. We were so afraid of the Japanese, et cetera. And, of course, it ended up being a bust. I mean, they ended up with some real estate in Rockefeller Center. You can do a lot with that. The Chinese look like they're on the same course. Their economy is constricting. There's a sense that there may actually be deflation taking place in China.
Yeah.
And, of course, the long-term trends are bad.
Right.
Their population is decreasing. So we have to worry about China because of Taiwan. And, of course, you always have to worry about a country when it's reached its apex and it may be going downhill, it might decide now's the time to take action because in 10 or 20 years, we're not going to be in a position to do so. So
right.
On one level, we have to be very careful and we have to be very vigilant as to what the Chinese are doing. On the other hand, you know, I'm getting a little bit tired of these warnings. China's going to take over the world. Well, you know what? With a shrinking population and an economy that's contracting versus an American economy that's growing and thanks to immigration, a population that's growing, I don't think we have much to worry about in terms of China taking over the world. But, you know, that's just my my view that we always like to have a villain. And I think we've made the Chinese too big of a villain because I don't think they have the potential that we all thought they did.
That's so interesting.
Thought Japan did, but we'll see.
That's so interesting. Well, the other issue, of course, is the central planning. And I shared a video with you that showed the overproduction of electric.
Right. There's another problem, by the way, that's taking place. You know, as we saw in the last year or so, or 2 years, when Xi began to crack down on the entrepreneurs, the head of Alibaba and some of the other big private companies, that's put a chill on the Chinese market and the willingness of entrepreneurs to take chances. And when you have that situation, entrepreneurs are not willing to take chances, but if they do want to take chances, they do it outside of China. And that's also created a cooling effect. You know, China was doing really well economically when it was moving more and more and more to the free market economy.
Right.
But once the government starts getting involved and say, oh, no, you're too big, and we're going to take over this company and take over that company, that puts a real halt to some of those things. And I think we've seen that happen in China, and it's having a bigger impact than we thought. You know, there are no countries at the top of the economic list, other than China, who just for size, that have really done well without economic freedom. Well, forget about political freedom for the moment, which is a whole complex issue. But without economic freedom and an independent court system, very hard for a country to do really well economically.
Right. So that's so interesting, Mark. Before I let you go, any comments at all on the heat wave that's being promoted around the world and the whole notion that we're having? It's kind of feeding into this whole climate change issue.
Well, look, I mean, we got to look at two factors. One, it was the hottest July in history. That's period. That's just a fact. There's no way of changing that.
The Earth is like 6 billion years old. I don't know that we know that.
The hottest July in our record of history. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Okay. Leave it aside the side of who's causing it. Let's put that aside. It's the hottest July in history. We're seeing changes we were not expecting taking place in Antarctica at the moment, things that could be very problematic. And we might be entering a period where things happened much quicker than was expected. There have been phenomena that's taken place in this past year that people weren't expecting until 2030, 2035. I'm one of those people who believe we need to be looking very seriously at climate mitigation and not so much the issue of, we probably stand on two sides of the issue of carbon and all those things, but I think it's too late for that. I fear that we 20 years ago, we can't do now, and we need to find ways of, we need to find ways to cool the earth if things start turning very rapidly in the wrong direction, which they could. I think we need to keep that in mind. Things are very unpredictable. Maybe things will just continue the way they are, but so far it hasn't been looking that way. And I think we need to be ready for that potential. Again, doesn't mean it will happen, but, anyone who does any serious risk management prepares for the worst.
Absolutely. Well, I will say from my point of view that it is actually not the warmest period in history, recorded history. Actually, go back to the 30s and the Dust Bowl. There were warmer periods then, and also that it's July. It's
there
hot.
There was not a worldwide period that was warmer during the Dust Bowl. Particular parts of the United States had a drought and were warm, but the overall heat in the world, the average heat in the world, not to mention the ocean, was not warmer during the Dust Bowl.
Well, I will say that there is a dispute about some of the facts on this, because there are places that are very, very warm right now in July, but other places that were cooler in July. So if you take a global look at this whole problem, my understanding is many scientists are saying this whole issue is overblown.
Okay, well, like I said, we sometimes read different sources, but I think we need... Let me put it this way. If you're right, it's all good, right?
Yeah.
If my concerns are right, it's all terrible. So if I'm trying to manage my risk, I'd prepare for the worst and hope for the best.
So I would suggest that we need to make sure that we're prepared for temperature changes and prepared for hurricanes and all the things that can happen. We should need to be better prepared for that, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's all driven by climate change.
Maybe not, but I think we need to be ready. Let's put it this way. If we determine at some point, and even some of the scientists seem to follow, come to the conclusion that the weather has become too dangerous and things are happening, the ice is melting too quickly in Antarctica, or worse yet, in Greenland, because the ice in Antarctica is not, on the shelf is not a problem, but the ice on top of Antarctica or in Greenland melts, the real problem. If those things are happening, they start happening quickly, we need to be ready to take action.
Yeah.
And ready to take action means investing in the research to know what that would look like. And I think that's a reasonable way of spending money for insurance, let's put it that way, risk management.
I can't.
I'm a strong believer in risk management.
I can't disagree with that. Again, Mark Shulman, the founder and publisher of HistoryCentral.com, multimedia website, great for kids of all ages, HistoryCentral.com. Mark, I know that you made a special effort to be on the show today because of your other commitments, and I really appreciate your commentary here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Have a great week.
You as well. Thank you so much. All right, coming up, we're going to be visiting with Larry Reed. He is the President Emeritus of the Foundation for Economic Education. We're going to do that and more right here in the Bob Harden Show on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
Stay tuned for more of the Bob Harden Show here on the Bob Harden Broadcasting Network.
Two-thirds of parents prefer educational options for their children, with 40% strongly preferring options for their child's education. School choice is a growing movement, one that is already lifting thousands of kids across America. The Optima Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, was founded to support the establishment and expansion of superior quality schools of choice. Optima's goal is the successful launch of Hillsdale College Varney Charter School, Initiative Classical Academies, and other schools of excellence across the state of Florida, serving kindergarten through the 12th grade. The mission is to train the minds and improve the hearts of young people through a content-rich classical education in the liberal arts and sciences, with instruction in the principles of moral character and civic virtue. and a terrific product of the process, Naples Classical Academy has already opened here in Naples. You can find out more by visiting the website optima.foundation. Help children in Florida optimize their educational opportunities. Visit www.optima.foundation. Do you suffer from joint pain in your shoulders, hips, or knees? I was suffering from debilitating pain in my knees. On a referral, I saw Dr. George Markovich with the Institute for Orthopedic Surgery and Sports Medicine. He successfully treated my symptoms and pain for several months. Finally, having exhausted all alternatives for pain management, Dr. Markovich and I agreed that surgery was my best alternative. Dr. Markovich replaced both of my knees in 2006, and I now have full range of motion in both knees, and I have no pain. I now play golf and exercise free of debilitating pain in my knees. Don't suffer needlessly with joint pain. Call orthopedic surgeon Dr. George Markovich with the Institute for Orthopedic Surgery and Sports Medicine at 482-5399. That's 482-5399. He did a great job for me, and he'll help you too.
Back to the Bob Harden Show. And now here's your host, Bob Harden.